Hello and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. And my name is Andrew Popel, and the show I host is Final Draft. And that's what you're listening to. It is books, writing, and literary culture for you every week. Coming to your airwaves, coming to you online and via the podcast. And look, it's another week in social isolation. I hope your reading is going well. There is still a stack of stuff going on in the world of books. And look, I mean, we might as well talk about it and share it. This week saw Carriage Works, which is just an incredible multi-platform arts venue in Sydney, go into voluntary administration. And of course, for many book lovers in Sydney, we'd be thinking this, we would have just spent a weekend in Carriage Works before COVID-19 for Sydney Writers Festival. So it is really sad news to hear that Carriage Works is doing it really tough financially. They've lost all of their revenue, effectively. I understand that there are talks that Sydney Opera House is looking to take over, that the board of Carriage Works are looking for ways through this crisis. And sometimes it can feel like from social isolation there's very little to do, but Carriage Works is an incredibly important arts venue in Sydney. So I wanted to keep you appraised of what's happening there, because I guess we all hope it is a place we're going to be going to see many more Sydney Writers Festivals and many more arts events when we all get to come out of social isolation. Sydney Writers Festival, of course, would have been happening last weekend and over that sort of end of April, beginning of May period. Now, of course, it couldn't go ahead, but Sydney Writers Festival, undaunted, have gone ahead and created a podcast series from social isolation. They are reimagining moments from their 2020 program, which is absolutely fantastic. So that podcast series is available right now. Next time you're on your podcast platform of choice, checking out the Final Draft Great Conversations platform, look for Sydney Writers Festival for artists like Alison Whittaker, who was due to deliver the opening night speech. She is a Gomeroi poet and just absolutely fantastic. She has come on the show before, and Alison is wonderful. Sweatshop Women, of course, featuring the amazing Winnie Dunn, amongst others, will be discussing their latest work. And also, I believe one of the podcasts is featuring Jess Hill, who recently won the Stella Prize for 2020. So Sydney Writers Festival podcast series, they're going to be reimagining their program for many months to come, as I understand it. So get out and check it out. Maybe after you've listened to Final Draft. And, of course, I am coming to you from 2SER. We record on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to the traditional owners of that land. 2SER is broadcasting undaunted despite lightning hitting our aerial, interrupting our signal. So thank you, everyone, for still tuning in across platforms. If you want to stay a part of the 2SER community and help us out, you can do a few things. You can support us by subscribing to our newsletter to keep up to date. You can become a 2SER supporter, or you can just make a donation. Go to 2SER.com and you will see buttons to link you to those. I know times are tough, but look, any donation you can make to 2SER is incredibly important. I have a great Australian author coming up on the show. This is an Australian author by way of New York. Madeline Watts has been based in New York since 2013, but she is a Sydney-born author. And her first novel, The Inland Sea, very much deals with Sydney. As I read it, I felt like I was walking around streets that I love, that at the moment I really can't walk around. The Inland Sea imagines an ordinary person on the cusp of beginning life post-university, but walking into a world that is beset by environmental catastrophe everywhere. The Inland Sea is just an absolutely amazing, wonderful read, and Madeline is a brilliant person to talk to. So I will be sharing that conversation after a short break. You are on 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and we'll be back after this short message.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. And right now I am joined online by a debut author. It is terrific to be speaking to her, and I get to speak to her face-to-face on the computer, even though you do not get to see her, dear listener. Madeline Watts is a writer. Her work has appeared in The White Review and The Lifted Brow. Her novella, Afraid of Waking It, won the Griffith Review Novella Prize, and Madeline is joining me today to discuss her debut novel, The Inland Sea. Madeline, thank you so much for coming on Final Draft.
No worries. Thank you for having me and for inviting me to do this Zoom interview. From so far away,
closer than we might have been. Part of the context for people, we would have originally been talking as part of Sydney Writers Festival, which was sadly, it had to be cancelled, and we are all social distancing for reasons that, you know, I'm not going to explain. People know too well. It is great to still be able to share your book with listeners. And in the Inland Sea, you deliver the reader to a Sydney that looks agonizingly familiar as we all sit in our homes socially distanced from our regular haunts. You let us walk those streets again in our minds. And your narrator has left the comfort of academia, finished university with barely a vague plan for what comes next. And she falls into a job as an emergency call center operator. She listens as disasters befall callers around the country. And we can see a picture emerge of a country and a people beset by environmental changes. And I thought, maybe can we start in that call center where the operators there are sort of a motley crew and each has their own ways and means of coping with this litany of disaster and tragedy that they experience over the phone, not just daily, every few minutes, and dealing with, or rather not dealing with, disasters that are these disasters that are kind of removed from us. That's a problem that I think the world as a whole is doing a really bad job of facing. How do you feel about this kind of dissociation from a grim reality?
I mean, I think that it just is. It's unfortunate, but with climate change and with the sort of, not just climate change, but all of the things that are connected to climate change that are like, because of the forces of the political world that we live in, the kind of like systems of imperialism and capitalism that inform all of it, it makes it really difficult to deal with any one thing at once, or to feel like anything is manageable, or that you as an individual, the very focus on the fact that the individual might be able to do something, it's really overwhelming. And it's not how we're used to living our day-to-day lives, in the way that everyone right now is not, it's not used, we're not, none of us are used to living our day-to-day lives the way that we are right now. And it's, I don't know, I read, there was an important book that I read when I was the sort of stages of redrafting the novel called The Great Derangement by Amitav Ghosh. And it's in some ways just like it's a very good book for other writers. But he talks about the imperative for writers to address climate change. And he talks about how strange it will be in 100 or 200 years' time for readers then to look back on the literature of today and see no real recognition or acknowledgement of the conditions that will really, really affect life then. As though like the domestic novel was just sort of going on without carbon being spilled into the air and without the oceans rising. And he talks about trying to find different ways to try and write about it, to write about how our individual lives keep going on and all of the other things, the disasters, they're all happening in and around our lives. And we sort of have blips of them. And certainly I have kind of daily spikes of small panic where I'll like read the news. I have like a rolling bookmarks page of just like climate catastrophe that I'll bookmark and I'll be like, yes, that's a bad thing. And then I'll go and make toast. And I think that is often the way that we experience the day-to-dayness of those disasters.
Let me ask you quickly about toast then. And not specifically toast, but in the novel, the call center operators, your narrator has a script to follow. And despite the abuse that's hurled at them, despite the distress that they hear in a caller's voice, they have to follow that script. Is toast part of your script? Are we all following a script there?
I don't know. I actually don't think we are necessarily, but there is a bit of like it's not quite an ostrich mentality. It's not like having your head in the sand, but it's too overwhelming to think about in totality every day. I don't know. Nobody has the answers to any of it. And I don't, you know, I wouldn't say that the book is necessarily hopeful about anything, but it's, you know, it's trying to sort of address like how life feels. And I think especially for people, so I'm 30 and I've grown up with a constant awareness of climate change. Like I remember being told about the greenhouse, I remember being told about the hole in the ozone layer when I was in kindergarten. And I always had this sense that the adults were dealing with it, and by the time I got to be old enough, things would be better and there would be things that would happen and there would be conferences. I remember there being a big one in 2009, I think in Copenhagen. And all of these things were meant to happen, and not like it's just been exactly the same for my entire life. It's just gotten worse and worse. And so there is just like a sense of, well, here we all are. We can't get out of it. We're all alive. We now have to learn to deal with it. And if toast is, you know, you still have to eat.
Have to eat. It's true. What about that way that we tell that story? Because Inland Sea, it is firmly rooted in storytelling traditions. Your narrator wonders at her own literary ambitions and rationalizes the call center work as, I was no different from anyone else who worked there, and my experience was the same as theirs. I was just the one writing it down. But you got me thinking, though, isn't that the most important difference? And we rely on those who are able to write it down to help us make sense of our everyday world. Like, why else are we reading these amazing books? I mean, entertainment is definitely one thing when you're not allowed out of the house, but there is something in books that helps us make sense of the world.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously still have, I think that books are very important. I think principally what books offer us in a way that most others don't is that they are the only way that you can really understand or hear what's happening in anyone else's head. They're the only way that you have the deepest access to somebody else's consciousness. And that is incredibly important. And so I think that they are tools for, not tools, but like they're the most empathic medium. Writing it down is, I don't know if it's like a morally virtuous act. I think it's important to do. I don't think the person writing it down is sort of doing any better than anyone else working in that call center.
That is a challenge that your narrator actually goes through as well. And even the way you just expressed that confusion that you were worried that you weren't clear enough. I don't know that we come to books because we want to be told, but it is nice to have a framework to start doing some of that work ourselves. And as you say, being able to get inside someone's head, having that empathic medium.
Yeah, I think that is important. It's always been important to me as someone who reads a lot and you know, read a lot as a kid. That's always been, seemed important.
Yes, you are on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and right there I was in conversation with Madeline Watts. We are discussing her debut novel, The Inland Sea. I do have more of that conversation to share with you, but let's take a track. This is from a Sydney-based band. They are called The Lazy Eyes. I want to share a track with you, and we are trying to support as much local music as possible. Remember, Sydney Musos, you can't go out and see them live just yet, but while you're socially isolating, you can listen to their music and support them. You can check out The Lazy Eyes on their Bandcamp, purchase some of their tracks, and get ready for a time when you can see them live. This is The Lazy Eyes with Tangerine.
Wait, when I've been.
You are here on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and right there we heard a track from the Lazy Eyes. They are a Sydney-based band. That track was called Tangerine. You can support them and other amazing Sydney and Australian artists. Go to their band camp, listen to their music, buy their music, and buy the books of amazing authors that we're going to share with you. Today on the show, I am in conversation with Madeline Watts. Her debut novel is The Inland Sea, and I can't wait to get us back to that chat with Madeline. Shadowing your narrator is the figure of John Oxley. Oxley was an explorer, he was surveyor general, and he ventured into the interior of Australia in search of a fabled inland sea that might open up the continent in the early 19th century. Oxley's journey created a really powerful narrative, even if he never found water. What do you want the inland sea, though, to tell us to say about the power of these sorts of narratives in the face of reality? Like Oxley, he went against what now looks to us, went against reason, but he created this narrative that is still pervasive.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just him. It was sort of the entire Enlightenment. And it's one of those things where like everyone, there's a general kind of thought, I think that, you know, is common to different ages. And when Europeans came to Australia, they were very cocky and believed that they knew what they were doing. And I was very interested in that kind of bravado. And I was very interested in that that particular journey, which I found to be fairly silly. Like it's a 6-week kind of jaunt to not very far from Bathurst. And then he goes back because it's like a bit hot and it's a bit uncomfortable and there's nothing that they can find to eat. But he sort of comes back and he's like, ah, you know, there's probably an inland sea out there, but I don't know, like, don't ask me too many questions about it. And based on that, like it generated all of these other myths, and, you know, sent other people out there who were, who believed in that kind of, believed that it must be there. And I was interested in the way that they were so, everyone in that sort of period of time believed that there had to be an inland sea out there because of, for reasons of like the science that they had at the time insisted that it, like, by definition of proportions, there had to be an ocean in the middle of, like, they just couldn't conceive of it. And that meant that they were blinded to everything else. And they were blinded to the like indigenous people in the country who knew what, like, knew about the land, who knew what to eat, who they, you know, who could have told them that there wasn't a sea. And that kind of, sorry, I'm being a bit long-winded, but I think that those ways of constantly, sorry, I've got a bit of a cold, so everything's coming to me a bit slowly.
No, that's okay, but that is a danger of these really certain narratives, isn't it? I mean, another narrative of Australian invasion and settlement is the story of Terra Nullius, which, you know, if it's believed as a story, informs our history in one way. And when we see it, I mean, it's a narrative that we're still trying to break away from so that we have proper recognition of 60,000 plus years of history, not just kind of 200 and a bit.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I think when you're stuck in those kind of narratives and you're so insistent on them and you believe in them so strongly that your mind can't break itself out of it. That causes not only damage in the period of time in which you live, but it causes long-term historical damage, as the myth of Terra Nullius has done and continues to do, and, you know, the entire history of Europeans in Australia has been a fairly unpleasant one. I was trying to sort of address all of that as well, because I felt like it would be, it was my feeling that I couldn't write about Australia now and not address those threads, particularly around the way that we treat the landscape and the way that we treat the environment. It's all linked to prehistory. It's all linked to like the first kind of settlers in Australia. What an incredible cat.
She has, this is Rocket. This is Madeline. Hi. Rocket decided that she was going to run around the computer, so I thought she had to say hello.
Yeah, I'm very glad. What a lovely tail.
This is, we might have to leave a little bit of this in the podcast cut. The way narratives are so formative, the way they do shape. I love what you kept doing with this in the story. And I saw in Oxley, as in many of the male characters, this idea of masculinity, or how masculinity is formed, to confront and tame something wild and also to conquer. But then against this, you give us the words of Pliny, taking us back many, many thousands of years before, that to mark, to take from the earth is a violence, and it's a violence that the earth will revenge. I wondered, like, is it right to try and create these overarching narratives, whether it's this idea of masculinity going out and taming the wild, or even that the earth is a female body? I wondered if these narratives are a violence in themselves, and if we try to stick too closely to them, we're doomed to sort of folly.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely believe that. I think that especially where the environment and the physical landscape is concerned, kind of, especially like in European history, I've always created these like big stories around them, and they become metaphors for human life. And the thing is that nature is not human, and it can function without us, and it can go on without us, and it functions completely outside of our metaphors and our stories and our narratives. And part of the problem a lot of the time is that it's the human incapacity to think about the natural world and the environment and the issue of climate change without resorting to these metaphors and stories that really, they block our thinking. They block our capacity to see the way that things are. And so I was sort of trying to bring out, particularly with the stuff about Pliny and like the way that there used to be biblical interpretations of like weather phenomena, and you know, like can't remember who it was, but there was a Protestant who said that the terrible earthquake that happened in Portugal during the 1600s was
Wesley
said that it was because God was angry at them because they were Catholic, and so he wasn't going to send any money to aid them. It's all of those kinds of interpretations. They just keep happening in different forms, and they're not helpful. So I liked doing a lot of that kind of essayistic stuff of just threading that sort of stuff through fiction. But that's, I was trying to sort of eke that out a little bit. So yeah.
Bear on us on that individual level as well. Your narrator is constantly writing down and observing historical facts about disaster, but then also is beset on all sides and even by herself for being too reckless, too self-destructive. And I wondered at this part of the narrative, because it felt like you were holding up the actions of those who were so certain, people like Oxley with his search for the inland sea, and a character we haven't mentioned, but of Lachlan, who is the ex who your narrator sort of has a new relationship with. And they went to uni together, and he's continued with his writing about Patrick White with the sort of certainty the narrator can't sort of muster for herself. But this masculine certainty, it's allowed to be foolhardy. It's allowed to be reckless, while the narrator must walk at night with keys between her knuckles. I wondered then whether we should all have license to be reckless, or maybe it's that we all actually should pay more heed. We should all be more cautious, or a little bit of both.
I mean, I don't know that there's an object lesson in it. I was definitely interested in portraying a time, or not a time in one's life necessarily, but a particular kind of attitude that doesn't care about being cautious or is not interested in being cautious, and what it's like to be someone to inhabit an arc that doesn't necessarily like get better. It doesn't tend towards like self-realization or self-betterment. It just kind of continues. And the only real, and I like that was very deliberate. Like I wanted that, that person to sort of be fragmenting and unraveling the whole time. And the ending is just that she leaves the country. And you're not given any direction as to whether she stops being reckless or she stops being self-destructive. But I was very interested in the way that there were ways that I felt that gender relations sort of are inscribed in Australia that I felt like I could say, oh, the cat's back. I felt like I could say that, not necessarily say it, but I could think about it a bit more clearly when I was no longer living in Australia. And it's all like, it's everything comes back to colonialism, everything comes back to the settling of Australia and the genocide of Indigenous Australians. But it's the way in which women kind of function in this country, particularly white women. Oh, she's settled. As you know, like you're meant to sort of be cautious. You're taught to be cautious. I was certainly taught to be incredibly cautious, and I was interested. I was interested in portraying people who just stop being cautious. Who know what they're meant to be cautious of, because that character obviously is like working in a call center, so she's afraid of everything because she's constantly more aware than ever of all of the bad things that could happen to her. And the only way that she can sort of keep functioning is to just be like, well, if something bad happens, it happens. Mm. Or maybe like, maybe she's sort of treading a line where she's inviting the bad thing to happen to her because she's constantly waiting for it. And so if it happens, then it's what she was expecting all the time. Yeah, there's not really a moral. There's not an object lesson in like,
Madeline Watts is the author of The Inland Sea, and we have been discussing it. It is an absolutely incredible novel, and I think this is probably amongst one of my favourite conversations and books for the year. It's also the first novel, the first conversation I've had on Final Draft that has featured Rocket the cat. So, Madeline, thank you for indulging my questions and also a little fairy tale flipping across the screen every now and again.
Did you know 2SER relies on donations and supporters to air your favourite programs? You can contribute too. Head to 2ser.com/support and choose between making a donation or clicking the supporter button. Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. I only have you for a minute or two longer. My name is Andrew Popel. Thank you so much to Madeline Watts. She joined me via Zoom to discuss her debut novel, The Inland Sea. And it is an absolutely terrific novel for Sydney-siders, for people who love Sydney, for people who've never visited Sydney. Get yourself a copy. Madeline so beautifully evokes this city in telling an incredible story about, I guess, the catastrophes that can sometimes seem to ring us around. I sometimes feel like this book could have come with a trigger warning because it did very much evoke both the summer we've just had and the time we're in right now. But it is wonderful. So thank you to Madeline. And look, before I say goodbye, you can take a little bit of the book action with you. There are a stack of great podcasts out there, including the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast and the Sydney Writers Festival podcast series. So whichever podcast app you listen on, you can do you can follow them both with a quick, just a quick search. Sydney Writers Festival, Final Draft, Great Conversations. You can also follow Final Draft on social media at Final Draft 2SER. My name is Andrew Popel. Look, I've got to go. I've got to say goodbye. I will be back next week with more books, writing, and literary culture. Until then, I wish you happy reading.